So we started off with this idea of coming to terms with difference, and it seems to me that both Yasmin and Hannah will have views, and I haven't sounded them out on their views. The whole idea is that I'll be as surprised as you are when I get to hear what they think about whether the world at large and whether the world in which we live in Ireland and Britain generally is coming to terms with difference. Of course, we spent some time this morning talking about differences here, and that's covered in all our newspapers and much of our poetry and on Facebook. There's hardly a day but someone's put up some new flags demonstrating their difference from some people in some other street who put up some other new flags or bonfires. I'm not sure if that's a great way of demonstrating difference, but there are other ways in which people demonstrate difference much more subtly. So what I'm going to ask each of our two guests to do is I'm going to say a little bit about difference and how I think it is and isn't working in different parts of the world. And then I'm going to ask them, Yasmin first and then Hannah, to talk or reflect on their experience of difference. And I think we kind of grew up with an experience of difference here that we thought was fairly unique. But over the years at the Hewitt Summer School, we've had people coming from Sierra Leone and Hungary and all over Eastern Europe talking about conflicts and the Balkans, conflicts that arise in different parts of the world, which are all based on difference. And Yasmin gave us a little bit of a hint about why that might be, and that is that as we become more globalised, instead of the whole world accepting Starbucks and Strictly as the kind of culture that everybody belongs to, the whole world is retreating backwards, or some parts of the world are retreating backwards, to look for some identity in this shapeless global world. I would have said over the years in the north of Ireland that the reason people have retreated more into their culture, be that Irish, nationalist, orange, Catholic, Protestant, those aren't words for culture, I know, but they're the words for all the things that we attach to culture, and they've retreated far more into it on both sides. And people here would say that's because of the troubles. We've been forced into it. We've been ghettoized. We've been driven out of the mixed areas we lived in. It doesn't apply perhaps to the very middle class people in the country, but we've become more ghettoized. And people have taken on things. Again, Yasmin talked about the veil, but we know here for many people, for a number of years, taking on the Irish language was a politicized thing, which it hadn't been when I was growing up in Ballycastle. Protestants and Catholics played traditional music together, learned the Irish language together. My father painted orange banners as a Catholic, painted orange banners, and some of them had Gaelic slogans on them. I don't know how many of them have Gaelic slogans when they parade up and down Donegal Street now. But so we have reverted. We have gone backwards because of the very thing that Yasmin was talking about this morning. I've watched the same thing with klezmer music in New York, where young Jewish kids growing up with the culture that their parents tried to shed have actually gone and rediscovered klezmer music and discovered the dance bands of the 1920s. It's one of the reasons, of course, for the preservation of Irish music, is that Irish exiles in Chicago found themselves in a completely amorphous place, and where Irish musicians in Galway and Sligo were trying to learn continental dance tunes and classical pieces, Irish musicians in Chicago were writing down what had until then been completely traditional lore. We wouldn't have most of the 1,000 dance tunes if we hadn't emigrated to a place where people were afraid of losing their culture, and that's what brought our culture back to us. So there's a whole complicated history in the Jewish diaspora, in the Irish diaspora, of actually trying to cling on to your culture. And I could hear echoes of that in terms of Muslims in the West, if we can use that generic term, clinging on to their culture. A very simple experience I had years ago with somebody working in the IT industry with me, and she had to, because of her parents, had to take an early train home because she wasn't allowed to be out after hours. She said the only time, and this is in England, the only time she got any freedom was when she went to her grandparents in India, because they didn't believe in any [S2] Yes. [S1] Of that stuff, and they treated girls like modern girls. So there's a few reflections on culture and how people in a situation where they're in a minority or where they feel oppressed will take on more and more of their home culture, which may be great. It may be traditional music. It may be the songs that Yasmin's been talking about. There are all sorts of positive things, and it may be very negative. They may want to be absorbed into the new culture, or they may want to hold on fiercely. So I'm going to ask Yasmin to reflect on that. Coming to terms with difference, is it the problem for the host culture, for the people who've arrived there? And we've all arrived from somewhere, believe me, certainly in this part of the world. How do we go about coming to terms with each other?
Well, I hope we can do more than just come to terms. There is this fear, I guess, of difference, of somebody who is utterly different and wanting to seem utterly different. What I think is helpful. We can all feel that. We can all feel, who is this person? I don't want to be associated with them. And it's a natural human thing. We were all, once upon a time, we didn't move beyond whatever circle we lived in. But I think what education and cultural entrepreneurs, gatekeepers, have failed to do again and again and again is to make a central space, a multiple space, but a multiple space of equality. I really hate it that, in London where I live, every day, every week, there is some kind of song and dance going on by an Indian or an African or whatever. It's great, it's wonderful talent, but it's a kind of department store of alien, entertainment, a superstore, and that's not the way this will change, where we need to be thinking primarily of each other as human, and then within that, the wonderful diversities that there are. There is a human rights template, which I think is universal. It isn't Western, it isn't Eastern. Actually, the UN developed it after the war, the Second World War. And once we have that common template, then we can actually begin to talk about a shared, ever-changing, absorbing, exchanging culture. So there are three models, and none of them at the moment are doing what I feel is where we want to all be. One is this idea of these fringes where all, the Black and Asian people dance and sing and are merry, and the centre remains unchanged and unchallenged. And the places where that changes is phenomenal when what happens. The Royal Shakespeare Company until 9-10 years ago was a white company. And every time a Black actor was given a bit part, the papers used to raise hell. How can a Black guy be? 10 years of having amazing people run that establishment, nobody even asks the question that, the greatest King Henry IV was played by an African actor. They have organically shifted, changed the center. That isn't happening nearly enough. But the cultural exchange that is harder is one where we are all living by the equality and human rights standards. So don't accept the oppression of women just because it's a cultural thing. Don't accept separation just because some white people hate Black people. I was on a train the other day, actually. I'm sorry, I won't take much longer. And there were 43 people on a train going on a trip to King's Cross from Lee. Where was I? I was going home from Leeds, and they were having a great time. And there was some part of some group, retired group, who would go off and do nice things. And it was all white. So I said to them, are there any Black or Asian people in your group? No. We like being with people like us. I'm sorry, that's not acceptable. Leeds is a mixed city. It's not acceptable. Even if you're just doing a nice thing, like going on a trip to London, how can you say to me, we want to be like people like us? And so that's the more difficult one. I can't force them to get Black and Asian people in, but I don't think it's acceptable that they think it's okay to say, we want to be like people like us. And that's the difficult one, I think.
That's fascinating in the sense that, how far can we go with rules and regulations? And I know, and somebody pointed out to me this morning, that the term coming to terms suggests a rather frosty encounter. Sometimes I think a frosty encounter where we know the rules of engagement with our neighbours might be preferable to no encounter at all, but it does sound like there should be some sort of rules, and I didn't mean it to sound like that when we first came up with the theme. But Hewitt did say, I would come to terms, I would be neighbourly, but you are so far. And I think he's saying the same thing that your people are saying. Yes, those people are there, but we haven't got to know them. They expressed it more positively than that. We don't want to get to know them, I think, is what they were saying to you. So, I also wonder if there's a generational change, and I'm not throwing a question at you, Hannah, because you're going to give us some reflections anyway, but whether London is more multicultural than a group of you didn't say there were OAPs out in Leeds, but maybe they were.
as old as I am.
but whether things are changing. But Hannah, just a general reflection, really, on difference in society and your experience. Can you?
Well, I suppose the first thing I want to say is that this idea about globalisation and that because of globalisation, various groups are retreating into their factions. I think it's been implicit in what you've been saying, but I think it's just important to spell out that globalisation doesn't mean that everyone around the world gets a Starbucks and then doesn't want a Starbucks. It means that half the world don't even get a Starbucks or any of that stuff. And that, you know, that is one of the root causes, is the unequal distribution of wealth and resources and the increasing gap between the developed and the developing world. And I just wanted to lay that out there as being one of the biggest structural issues in this discussion about why people are retreating perhaps into some kind of like essential sense of culture, their own culture. I'm also not sure that that people do have an innate fear of difference. And I'm going to give an anecdote, really, which is slightly innocent, I think, about my going to primary school in Ilford in Essex, an incredibly multicultural primary school with children from really all over. But I still remember, like, my best friend was a Muslim girl, Mina. I had another very good friend who was a Sikh boy in Nepal. And I had lots of other friends in my class from all kinds of backgrounds. And at that time, even though Margaret Thatcher was doing her best to sort of define Britain on monocultural terms, the school that I went to had this remarkable head teacher who was a Christian socialist, and he was really trying to lay the foundations of multicultural education. I think what he was doing is now critiqued as being the kind of sari and samosa approach. You know, like one day we're all making samosas, the other day we're learning to play the steel drums, so forth. Next day everyone's mums comes in and we all put saris on. But I remember that as being incredibly culturally democratic. And it was really fostering the mixedness that I already had in my home life was really being reinforced for me at school. And I didn't have a fear of difference. I had a great love of difference. And I think I've carried that through me my whole life because of those foundational moments in my education. So when people are scared of difference or concerned about the dark stranger or whatever, I always think about who does it benefit, you know, that difference to be allowed to flourish, I suppose. And you see it in examples going back throughout history. I think about my dad growing up mixed race in Jamaica, part black, part Chinese, and the Chinese elders had these names for these mixed children. Ship Yit Tiam was one of them. It meant 11 o'clock child, not quite 12 o'clock. Not quite good enough, right? And another one was Chinese Royale. It was ironic. How could you be royal Chinese when you've got black blood? And he was called those names. Well, you think the Chinese arrived in Jamaica as indentured labourers. The black people there had just been given their freedom from slavery. But the colonial government and powers had no interest in fostering good community relations between the Chinese and black communities. So that difference, that fear of difference, that discrimination was allowed to flourish. Same with my nan. I talked about in my poetry reading earlier, I talked about my mum's racism towards my dad, who was from Jamaica. And her racism was completely born out of like imperial, kind of British imperial superiority, but also invigorated by that working class discourse of they come over here, take our jobs, take our. And I think, you know, whenever you're having these conversations about fear of difference, you only need to look about who it's benefiting. And while we've got a government at the minute that is increasingly trying to take away from the poor and disenfranchise people even more, fostering a fear of difference serves the government well. And that is what I see happening in the UK. Now, one more small
anecdote.
Yeah,
keep going, keep going.
I live in Wood Green in Haringey, one of the most multiracial areas of London, also one of the poorest. And we managed to buy a shared ownership flat. You know, you can't buy any property. You can buy a shed in London now if you're rich. We've managed to buy this shared ownership flat. We own 40% of our flat in this new block of flats. And there's legislation. Whenever you build a shared ownership block of flats, you have to build social housing, council housing next door. So there it is, this new, two new blocks. But we've got, the shared ownership side, have got a foyer and a nice entrance hall and a lift inside. The architecture of the social housing, all built at the same time, is that typical outside walkway, outside lift. It's a bit dirtier, grungier. Okay, we've got a communal garden. It's got hot, and all the kids have been outside playing, and there are people in these flats from, like, all over. There's Polish, there's people from Czech, Indians, Bangladeshis, Chinese. And all the kids, including my own little son, they're out there playing, and it's all just lovely. And there you are, I'm thinking, oh, this is wonderful. It's utopia. It's so, you know. And then the side of the social housing get a letter 2 weeks ago. The social housing children are not allowed to use the garden.
What?
Right? Are not allowed to use the garden. Only the shared own. You know, and this is, to me, is a wonderful metaphor. Some people are allowed in the garden, other people aren't allowed. And if you've got, the less you've got, the more less likely you're allowed into the garden, right? It's an obvious metaphor. But what also worries me is when I then sort of was rabble-raising about it with my side, so this is terrible, this has happened. You know, some of the residents were saying, these aren't rich people, by the way, these are people that have just managed to get onto the housing ladder by the skin of their teeth. They're saying, but are our kids allowed in the garden still? You know, they're sort of worried. Were you going to write a letter? Well, I don't know, put my name on it. I don't want to cause trouble.
Yeah.
And that is exactly the kind of mentality that serves the authorities and those that have power.
Well, of course, it's
and that creates difference and division. So those are the things that are concerning.
Of course, I mean, it's fascinating everywhere that in London and certainly in America, some of the most conservative people, the people who are trying to hold back what they call the illegals, and I get emails every day from the American right wing. I'll explain sometime why I do that. But I like to keep a tap on what's going on over there, you know? I get their constant obsession with illegals, and the people who are signing those off, and the guy that got me into this loop in the first place is a guy called Mulcahy. So you don't have to work out where he came from, and you don't have to work out where all the Polish names on that list came from. But they are right-wing Americans who are keeping out the Hispanics, the Puerto Ricans, the Mexicans. One of them even had a long diatribe about saying, how did so many Mexicans get into California? So nobody has actually told them that when America captured California, there were a lot of Spanish-speaking people there. So those kind of myths are going on, you know. But it is this sense that each subsequent wave of immigrants, and there was a whole thing when we first came to London in the 70s where it was Asian people thinking they were much better than the black Afro-Caribbean immigrants and so on. That has moved on to Somalis and then, of course, the whole East European thing. Just the thing about Polish kids there reminded me of your remark about the Latvian airmen, but somebody did when they were talking about people coming over here taking our jobs and they were celebrating the Battle of Britain, and somebody said, all these 170 airmen coming over here taking our jobs and saving Britain. So, you know, the idea, certainly in London, that we were all English until sort of 1948. When was the Ormond, Anna?
My dad came on a boat before the Windrush, you know.
Yeah,
that little fact, I hope, makes people really question the whole Windrush story. And as Yasmin was talking well earlier about the white women with their black lovers in the 1500s, you know, it's a myth.
But there was a communist Asian MP in Battersea in the 1890s.
There were four Asian MPs, all elected by white people in the late 19th century. But the interesting thing is, I also want to look at the good side, because sometimes it can be so depressing and you think we're all just splintering away. In June, during Refugee Week, I was asked to compare an evening in Crawley, which is quite near Dover, whereby a group that calls itself Friends of the Gatwick Detainees, because those seeking asylum or who are economic migrants, if you're starving, we will all become illegal migrants. If a day comes when we're starving, and you know that in Ireland, okay, we do that, humans do that. So what they did, these amazing people, actually, from that area in Dover and Crawley, they go to the detainees who are detained indefinitely. So it's a form of torture. You're put in there by our elected government, and they don't know what they've done, and they don't know what's going to happen to them. And some of them become very severely distressed and so on. So these people visit them, and what they did was so tremendous. It was such an example. They walked. They got together with other people in the area, and they walked 90 miles from Dover to Crawley. And they sent amazing poets and writers to visit the detainees. And all along the way, they wrote poems and stories about the detainees. They recreated the pilgrims' tales. And it was astonishing. So on the final night, I couldn't go to the walk or anything. I was supposed to just do a final, end of a little play by some asylum seekers and so on. And Ali Smith had written this beautiful, beautiful testimony. 750 people turned up for this event in an area which we know as very hostile, you know, the Dover, they come on the bus. Yeah. And so I just feel that there are imaginative ways of getting this togetherness, which is happening. We just don't hear about it, because partly because of my profession, which is horrible most of the time. And at another event, I met Mohammed, who was an Eritrean. Mohammed was one of the boat people, recent boat people, who nearly died, was rescued, and is now here. And what it he was speaking at the same time as the family in the East End went off to join ISIS. Yeah? And he said, and I was just thinking, why would you do that? Why would you do this? And what he said was so astonishing. He said, I just want to be free. Eritrea is like a prison for its people. We have no rights. We have to go into the military. We're not paid. We cannot speak. We're tortured and we're killed. I just want to work and I want to be free. I want to be here to be free. And I just thought, if Mohammed had talked to this family,
stopped them going,
they might have not gone.
Amazingly. I just wanted to pick up on something you said there about your profession, and the media has a complicated relationship with all this, and also on what Hannah's saying in terms of who profits, because even in that American scenario, I can't quite see why all these third and fourth generation immigrants profit by keeping out more immigrants. And this is, there's a story that's not being told there. But I was fascinated on the, again, I'm always talking about the Today programme, so it tells you I spend far too much time in my car driving to places. But there was one morning where they'd gone to visit what they call the jungle in Calais, and this is about all the refugees are trying to come over. And they went to visit a street of very ordinary houses. And you could hear the reporter doing the build-up, and these are nice, tidy houses, and they're only just across the road from this fenced-off, what looks like a concentration camp to me. And I'm going to ask these ordinary French people what they think about having these hordes of migrants on their doorstep. And the French people came out, and to a man and a woman, they said, yes, I bring them food. We collect old clothes for them. Yes, we've got blankets for them. We've been all around the Pas de Calais collecting for them. And we love having these people here. Some of them will do work for us, and we'll pay them a little bit of money. I know we're not supposed to. And you could just hear the reporter getting further and further down, thinking, what a waste of airspace they are. But they played the piece, you know, to be fair to the Today programme, they put it on there. And I think what's in it for, I understand what's in it for the right wing to keep maintaining this, what's in it for journalists to write this endless stuff in the Daily Mail, demonising people and so on, when there is, and I mean, one of the things that I think applies everywhere is, and I talked about it in terms of Northern Ireland, there is a myth about two different races, two different groups of people. They came from here and we came from there, or we came 400 years before them. And it's all nonsense, because we all married each other over the years. No matter what anybody tells you, you will find nobody that isn't two or three generations back. And I think that there is some hope. Of course, it goes against all the religions. It went against religion here, and people have moved beyond that. It certainly goes against the Jewish religion and Islam and so on to marry out. But people are doing it more and more. And whether there is a future there in a world in which people have grown up in the kind of primary school you described with the samosas and saris and so on, and the world just does move on. Is this all stuff that people are going to move away from, or will those powers that be keep drumming up different groups? Do you want to...
One, you know, amazing sort of thing strikes me about the whole thing relating to the Windrush is that, you know, when the people that came on the Windrush to Britain came in 1948... We all know that story. It's a story that's been augmented by the media now. It's become like the formation or story about Britain's multiculturalism. But those people that came on the Windrush and on ships after, they were unable to find housing. They were sleeping in telephone boxes. They were riding buses all night long. They were completely de-skilled in terms of the employment they could find, la, la, la. Jump forward 50 years to 1998. These same people are now being heralded in a sort of struggle to success story as pioneers that paved the way for future generations of Caribbean people in Britain and so forth. A huge turnaround in 50 years of their reception to where they're perceived now. It's almost like imagining the way that the media now present Romanians. Imagine in 50 years we're talking about the Romanians as being pioneers. You know, these people are pilgrims. This is the kind of shift in language. We have to be suspicious of the media and what it does. That, I mean, of that type of complete spin around. Because it's the same story. You know, the colonial relationship is different for sure, but it's economic migration. And the door to Britain is always half open, half closed to economic migrants.
And that's so true. And it doesn't even start. I mean, you know, when we came from Uganda, it was awful. We were going to... absolutely destroy these islands, sink them because we were so unwanted. And now even Nigel Farage says how much he loves us, partly because everybody else but me became a millionaire. And you know how much politicians love millionaires. But if you look back, go further back, because I've looked at in exotic England, when the Huguenots came from France, you know, they were fleeing France because the French Reformation decided there was only one way to be a Christian and Protestants weren't welcome. And so they all came here and their houses were burned and their businesses were destroyed. And there was a chap, William of Orange, wanted to give them full rights. Whatever they weren't quite citizens. We're not even now citizens, we're subjects. And there was a chap called John Knight, a member of Parliament, who said in Parliament, throw out the bill and throw out the foreigners. This is in the 17th century. And Parliament had that pamphlet burnt because they said this is not how such a house should be discussing. So you always have this alternative story. And so it was with the coming and going of Jewish people. You know, they were welcomed, and then, and with the Huguenots, they then set up the Bank of England. And even to this day, I think there's a particular Huguenot family which has the right to make the paper which makes the banknotes that we use. But it's a rite of passage. You go, 1972, I was sitting in a park in Oxford and I got spat at. 8 months ago, I'm sitting on a number 9 bus on High Street, Ken, and I was spat at again. This is only the second time in my life. And it was a woman in her 50s, early 60s, who didn't know who I was, but said, effing Paki, go back where you came from. And you're so right, the rhetoric in the last election, what happened was unbelievable. Just when we thought we were over the worst of the Enoch Powell talk, it came back with a vengeance. Yeah, for sure. And it really affected all of us. You know, it has really affected us. And yes, you're right, it serves power to have this. But then on the other hand, the retribalization is also a worry because, you know, previous East is East, the film, there was real integration in the 50s when migrants came from the South, from South Asia and other places, working amongst working classes particularly, because they all worked in factories together. They were unionized. They needed each other. And then in time, the separation has gone worse and worse. And the saddest thing for me when I go to schools and I talk to parents of young children is how many times they will say, you know, either my daughter is not invited to the birthday parties if it's a white family, or the other way, Muslim children are never allowed to go for sleepovers to white houses. And so this kind of, at that level, and you're right, children aren't fearful, they become, they're taught to be fearful in time, that we don't even have that interaction of birthday parties anymore in some areas. It's quite heartbreaking, actually.
Well, it's quite interesting. It's one of the points that Hewitt made in his poem, The Coasters, because he's talking about how middle-class people, at least in the North, were getting on in the 60s. And, of course, he's underlining that by saying, actually, secretly, you were still spreading all the old lies and all the old prejudices. But one of the points he makes was, of course, your children never mix with theirs because they go to different schools. So that's one of the first questions you asked me when you got here. And yes, the integrated schools is still a project, but church schools or church-based schools or state schools versus church schools is still a major problem of how people spend their time together.
Oh, and can I just say about the mail, very quickly? You know, we know what it does. It rings me almost every week to write for them because they like my writing. And once in a while, I will write for them. And there are surprises. Like the other day, they said, would you write a piece for us, 1,800 words, on how good it would be for white working class kids to be bussed over to schools with ethnic minority children because they would learn about the value of education. So I had to... I said, are you sure? Are you sure? Yes, we should bus them. This was the word. We should bus them and learn about, you know, the ethics. And even more surprising, in these books that I'm editing, the Refusing the Veil is part of the... guess who wrote a book defending migration for me? Actually, with my help, because he can't write. Kelvin McKenzie. Kelvin McKenzie has written a book called What Have Immigrants Ever Done For Us? And he says, and actually he's put a lot of passion into it, that when he left this job as the editor of The Sun, went out into the real world, he had to really learn how wrong he was. You know, so you can get friendships or friendly voices in the most unusual places.
Okay, I mean, I think we're talking generally around a subject, but it's a subject here everybody must have feelings on. I mean, Northern Ireland kind of stayed out of some of the racist issues of the 60s and 70s, both because of lower numbers of people coming here. I can imagine having got all the way here, whether you came on the Windrush or came from Edie, I mean, the last thing that you needed was to head straight into Northern Ireland and meet another bunch of problems. And it comes back to the old argument, yes, I know you're Asian, but are you a Catholic Asian or a Protestant Asian? So, I mean, the only thing to be said in favour of Edie, I mean, was he would have fitted in very well here because he played the accordion. But he had a number of other crimes other than accordion crimes to his name. So that whole idea, I think, has had a much higher profile. It's a terrible thing to say, but as the troubles have died down, racism has become much more prevalent, and we're not immune from all the ills of modern society. But I wonder about people's experience here, and is there a new generation growing up with a new tolerance? Is it helping people to forget the difference between Catholicism and Protestantism if they're having to deal with Polish and Latvian Catholics and Lithuanian Protestants, or it may have been the other way around? And deal with a greater racial mix. I know racial intolerance in the South because I reviewed a series of plays that were on at the Peacock, which is the studio part of the Abbey Theatre, and I think 6 out of the 10 plays were about immigration, asylum seekers, about people who didn't have permission to stay, about medical students who were being beaten up because their permit didn't allow them to stay long. And that's maybe 10 years ago, so that was a big issue then, and you only have to watch Facebook to see what the issue there is. And I think there are two things going on there. One of them is an Irish-Ireland mentality that still exists, and I think the other one is that we are going to be regarded as by Britain as the weak link in terms of letting loads of people in here who can then cross over the border into Northern Ireland, and suddenly they're in Britain, and Britain is pushing on Northern Ireland and Ireland to push back. So all of that big stuff is going on. It's a small country in terms of the whole of Europe, but we are regarded by Britain as a gateway. But I'm just wondering what the experience is here and whether people feel that racism, as opposed to the other cultural differences that we talked about earlier in the day, is something that Northern Ireland is dealing with, that Ireland is dealing with, or that we don't have to deal with because they can just join up and be Catholics and Protestants like the rest of us. Any thoughts, any questions, and any comments on what you've heard over the 2 days, really? So, yes, here we are. Thanks, Gerard.
I live in the East Belfast, so quite close to the interface area, very loyalist, very Protestant area, and there are issues all the time with racism. You go to the village, Donegal Pass, you've got all you've got to do is walk down the alleyways and you're seeing all the stuff down there, the swastikas, the KKK, BNP, that stuff is there and it's been ignored. It's been taught on the knee. There's no leadership within loyalism, as I see it. The racism is a real problem and I don't think it's been addressed properly at all. I think, you know, we haven't had the document from... Well, we're supposed to be getting that strategy document from our leaders. but how long has it taken them for that to come through? We're not getting leadership on it. They're too busy. We've got the two extremist parties. The middle ground has there's no place for the middle ground at the moment.
I think that's a very interesting contribution, John. I mean, one of the things that I was talking about this morning was the relationship between thinking in Northern Ireland, particularly biblical thinking, and South Carolina, where those massacres took place, but the fact that people in East Belfast hoisted a Confederate flag at that moment in history shows us how their resentment, they're not bothered about they just want somebody to resent almost, so they'll pick somebody anywhere. And that seemed to me that Belfast was probably at its lowest point, raising a Confederate flag after the death of 9 people in a Protestant church. Yeah, they raised a Confederate flag. The local football club took it down almost immediately, to their credit, but what muddled thinking is going on there? So, that's a very important contribution. Anne's got a question.
I'm retired now, but when I was working, I worked with groups of agencies that provided services for children. And one of the projects that we funded was a children's rights project, because what reminded me was what Yasmin said about, you know, the rights providing the space for everyone to be together on an equal basis. And what that did was enable children aged 7 to 12, mostly from the Eastern Europe, who had settled in Dungannon and round about near this area, to talk about their lives in relation to the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child's set of rights for children. And that enabled agencies to hear what children's lives were like in a much clearer way than asking particular groups of children particular questions. It was asking all the children the same questions based on rights, which was really, 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 really helpful. I did have another point, but I've forgotten it.
Thanks for that. I mean, I think that's a general comment on the more time children spend together without these barriers being put up. And some of them barriers are being put up by a hostile state that has something to gain by pointing out that people are immigrants or people are different. Some of the barriers are put up by families themselves, sure, and their own culture, which they don't want to lose, but they're putting impossible barriers in front of integration and coming to terms. Yes, Tom.
The move by some of the politicians against integrated education by coming in this so-called sequence of sharing schools, where in fact youngsters are going to go in by different doors, they're going to wear different uniforms, and I see that as a direct attack on the integrated education, the way it was developing, and it's aimed at slowing down the progress by the integrated section to be more available to the whole community.
Yeah, that again, quite an important point. And integrated schools has obviously been an issue here. One of the problems, and it was the same problem in Alabama. Not I'm going to spend all my time talking about the fact that we spent the spring in the southern states of America, but it was the same problem in Alabama 50 years ago, and that is that if these people live here and those people live there, you can only bus them. And so in middle-class areas, it's easier to create an integrated school, partly because there are less ties to the worst aspects, the poorer aspects of the community, and also because there's less need for busing, because if people can all afford to live in that area, that's a possibility. Yeah. Busing children from the Falls to the Shankill. I mean, the history here of school buses having to pass through certain areas and even children having to pass through certain areas to get to Holy Cross tells us that there would be problems if all schools were integrated. One of the differences there is that in Britain there isn't an issue about integrated schools, but you do find that some schools are going to end up predominantly white because that area is like that, and some of them are going to end up predominantly from different places. And people just seem to get on with that. I don't know whether people perceive that as being it's obviously a benefit. Are people perceiving that as a problem? Is there white flight? Is there?
Well, it's not that. It's not that simple, is it? Because one of the great phenomenons now in sort of middle class parenthood in London is moving to get your child into the school that you want them to, or if you're rich enough, just renting a flat and pretending you live there while remaining in your nice big house.
And is that largely a race thing or a class thing or a bit of both?
It's a class thing, and therefore it's a race thing, because essentially there's not a significant black middle class in Britain in the same way there is in the US. Yeah, yeah. So we're talking about white parents doing
it. It sounds like that. Yeah, okay, yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
Right. It's interesting, all this stuff about sort of geographical space in terms of what you're talking about here in Ireland, but also like my experience of living in the US for a while. I went to university in California in the late 1990s, where an incredibly radical curriculum in terms of the study of, like, you know, I was studying Chicano Americans, political theatre, and Chinese refugee literature, and it was literally the most racially segregated place I'd ever lived. The foreign students were told not to cross the river into the kind of the area where the Mexicans lived, in what appeared, you know, it was really sort of very poor project housing. And I just found that there's great tension between, you know, on the one hand, this very radical and forward-thinking, progressive curriculum, and then obviously terrible community divisions. And I suppose a parallel for me, sort of, in London, of course, is that you might have freedom to go to whatever school as a young person now in London. It's not really like that, because you're kind of dictated by your postcode. But there's also the whole thing for a lot of young people in London, in certain places of London, about the areas they can go into because of this kind of postcode stuff and this turf war and gap. And I don't really understand the machinations of it, but apart from the fact that I know, having taught in the inner city sick form, it was a real fear for students. And it was something they had to negotiate daily. And I think that's a terrible burden for young people you know, 15, 16-year-olds to fear mortally.
Well, I think that gang warfare thing, Ronan Bennett, when he was last here, talked about a film he was making for TV. And I can't remember the title, but it was about the kids in the area he was living in London. And when he went into schools and talked to them, the Somali kids said, the Turkish kids are much smarter than we are because they get their guns at 12 and we don't get our guns until we're 14. And so they were living in fear of these other guys who had guns sooner. And that was kind of... So there are other things other than just forcing everybody to be together. It's how you cope with that togetherness and difference.
Yeah, and I'm also slightly worried about talking about the gang stuff. I do think the media really... stirs things up in terms of presentation of gangs, but I also know that I saw some of that.
Yeah, I kind of trust Ronan Bennett, but there we are. So another question coming. Yeah.
It's more of a comment, actually, just about going back to your point, it is about resources, because those schools, the state schools in London, all my friends and family are paying now, won't let their kids go to the local state schools because they are so appalling. They just won't get an education there. So it does always come back to it. And again, I think that's what's happening in the north, is that the Protestants are ending up in the state schools, and of course the Catholics have their own church schools, which are much better. So whenever I've been working in the peace programme under Peace 3, working with loyalists and stuff, that was always the problem that they foresaw. But actually, what I wanted to also raise was your point, Yasmin, about the positive side of it, because I read a book by a guy called Satnam Verdi. Do you know him?
Yes.
Yeah, about radical outsiders, racialized outsiders, which was really interesting, because what it showed was that throughout the whole history of British kind of radicalism has always been led by outsiders, whether they be Jewish, Black, Hungarian, Irish. Each sort of movement is actually led by an outsider of some kind involved in Britain or living in Britain. So I think it's really important to be aware of that, that there's a real role for people, and that has happened, like your story of Crawley, you know, that it does happen. And that's one of the best bits about Britain, I think, in some senses, that there are these communities who actually stand up and do things and start fighting for their rights. And that just leads me finally to this last comment, which again about is the media. And I think that's a huge problem, you know. We've got to be more than suspicious of them. I mean, personally, I don't read them anymore. I don't read the papers. I'll listen to the Today programme and Morning Ireland. But I don't read the papers. I don't watch the TV news. Now, that leads me to Facebook or The Journal or some of those sorts of things, but I don't really trust that. So increasingly, I'm getting isolated, and I'm aware of that, but I'm nearly 60, and I think, feck it, you know. Let other people deal with the problems. But it does lead to that sense of isolationism, and on Facebook, it's all about individuals. Yeah. And that's a real problem. And in the past, you know, when newspapers were first begun, they gave you information, they were news, they drew people together, they created communities of coherence, of interest, of activity. Facebook doesn't do that. No. So what I want to know is what you're all going to do about it.
I think you should read The Independent.
That's a good answer.
Frankly.
That's a good answer. I just, Geraldine. Can we take Paul next? He's been waiting for a while there. Thanks for that contribution. We'll take a couple more contributions and then we'll...
Sorry, I was just, I was curious, picking up on that point about the media, and Cahill raised the point about the Confederate flag being raised, and Hannah's reaction was, oh, my goodness, I didn't hear about that sort of thing. And I was wondering what the media's reaction is, or thoughts about Northern Ireland are now. Is it sort of done and dusted? Is it something that they don't want to revisit in the wider sense? A story like that, if it happened, for example, in Leeds or in London, it would make national news. Sure. It doesn't make national news because it happens in Northern Ireland. Is that the way it works?
I think there's a kind of... I don't think it's as sinister as that. And the media, the biggest selling papers... do actually damage the very thing we're trying to talk about here. But I have been very disappointed in the way the BBC has been recently. To have Nigel Farage on Question Time 19 times over that year before the election, when he didn't have a single MP, and now only has a single MP who ran away from the Tories, told you how far kind of to the right it was going. And I find it... I can't listen to the Today programme a lot of the time now, especially with Humphreys going on. Michelle is saying I can listen to it. You often do hear. So I think, I think the Northern Ireland thing is a really interesting question. I think there is a kind of dream world in the psyche of the United Kingdom. Look what we did there. It was a society utterly torn apart, and we made peace. And it's not cynical. I think it's just not wanting to let go. It's not like, not wanting to admit that your uncle is a drunk. You know, you want to keep something cherished. I think it's to do with that they don't want to give you the bad news. And again, they'll say, look at Blair. Why do you want to judge him on the war? Look what he did in Northern Ireland. It's become part of the cherished...
A good news story.
There's a wonderful moment where they say that we're going into Fallujah and we're sending in British troops who served in Northern Ireland because of how successful they were there. And you thought, 30 years, It didn't quite work out like that. But, I mean, that whole idea... that we brought peace is quite an interesting one.
We should just stop all funding of state-funded religious schools, all of them. That's what we need. We need to get rid of this. Instead, we're building more and more.
Are we going to try and explain why it was a socialist party that brought that in rather than a conservative party? Are we going to try and explain why it was a socialist party that brought in all-day drinking and licensed gambling in the UK, all the things that the decent Methodists and Irish Catholics and Presbyterians in Scotland were against? Sorry?
You mean Labour, not Socialist.
Okay, thanks for that. Labour. We got that one sorted. You see this audience, we got that one sorted in seconds. There's another question up at the top there. Geraldine.
Hello.
Let's just take Hannah's comment on that last
bit. Tiny point about the media and Northern. It's a forgotten story because we have a new enemy. That is the point. It's not now you hear the Irish accent and you worry about a car bomb. You get on the train, a tube, and you see a man with a rucksack and a beard. And that is the new story. I mean, were there 2 years? When there wasn't someone,
the gap. There was a moment. You and yours the other day were talking about 7/7 and said, obviously in a spirit of egalitarianism, if you've been affected by bombs like this on 7/7 or even by the Irish, and I thought, brilliant, wow. Okay, so that's the language isn't even looked after properly anymore. But there's another question coming up here.
Hello. Hello. I, like John, live in East Belfast. I come from mixed background. At the moment, come September, I'm starting a poetry night in Tullycarnet Library. Now, Tullycarnet is a huge Protestant estate. My grandparents on my father's side were Republican. I was brought up in a Protestant working class community, so I have a kind of appreciation. This goes back to the racial issues that we're having in our society here. Within the Catholic community and with Irish nationalism, there is an appreciation of culture. My grandmother didn't go to high school or anything, but she could recite Shakespeare. In the Protestant community where I was brought up, if you were intelligent or academic or did poetry, that was like you were getting up yourself. Who are you? You know? John Hewitt, who was Protestant, I can guarantee you if you go into Protestant, he was Catholic. Oh, he's at that John Hewitt summer school. Oh, Seamus Heaney, they're Catholic. We have a huge issue within the Protestant community about... and the problem is, in our education system, I did an access course. There was no female authors, but there was also, it was very nationalist. Coming from Queen's University, there is a very prominent nationalist movement, which I appreciate from one side of my thing, but I can see how it's so threatening. If you come from a Protestant background and all you're reading is Brian Murr and the white phallic city hall system, how they can feel they don't have any other culture than the bands and the whatever else, and that's what they feel they have. And it is our job, and I feel in our education system and within the arts, we have to breach this that Catholics are educated and cultured and Protestants are not. I'm in a battle at the minute. I don't know how to do it. I'm just trying to do it in the library
We're going to pick up a couple more questions, but if I can just comment on that one, and there's someone over here, Geraldine. If I can just comment briefly on that to say that this... to me over the past 28 years has been the one space, and I've had people come to me here who are ex-terrorists from both sides and who are from underprivileged communities on both sides and saying the arts and the Hewitt Summer School are the one space where I feel that we get to talk about that. I'm sure there are other spaces, as they always say on radio, there are other festivals you can go to and talk about these things, but it seems to me, yeah, the fact that we're here does mean we're doing the work, but that question of Protestant culture is quite a complex one. Just if we can pick up this other question. Yeah.
How's it going? My point is just that sometimes you look at history, you know, it was, you know, the divide was, you know, hero and coward or saint and sinner, and now it's almost between the healthy and the unhealthy. You know, you're unhealthy if you don't have a job. You're unhealthy. You're not, no longer unemployed. You're jobless, as in hopeless, or you're unhealthy religiously, and that seems to be the main divide for me. It's no longer black and white or rich and poor. It's healthy and unhealthy, I think.
Yeah, I think if we. I mean, one of the responses to that, somebody asked a few moments ago, what are we going to do about this? But one of the responses to that is that those things all line up, don't they? In a sense, that there is going to be more bad health and disability and people not working in underprivileged communities, and underprivileged communities are going to have a higher representation of whoever the last bunch of migrants is, whatever their reasons for coming there. So if we take one more question, then we'll do a kind of a roundup. So if we could have a comment or a question up there. Thank you.
Hey, thank you. I just wanted to say, actually, similarly to what the girl over there was saying, where I'm living now in Lisburn, around Ballymacash estate, they have the flags, the Union Jacks, up around the estate, and they also have the pirate flags, the skull and crossbones, which, apart from the side of it being comedy gold, you know, there is kind of, it is quite sad, and I think it reflects, actually, that there's been kind of a vacuum where people are clinging to culture identity and trying to reclaim that, and I think that, actually, in Protestant Northern Ireland, there's an element of... I remember an aunt complaining that as a Protestant Ulster woman, she couldn't be Irish. And I think that actually the way to maybe fill that void and also is to recognise how much we are mixed and how much the Irish culture has influenced Protestant people. But of course, in the state schools, and as it was said, that Protestant people go to the state schools and mostly the Catholic children are sent to the church schools. There's very little now, a little bit more now, but certainly when I was in school, there's nothing of local history. There was nothing taught of local history, and you are kind of a little bit isolated, and I think that that's something that could be really invested in if politicians took the lead on that, and, you know, with the 12th, instead of repressing it or encourage it to be more Irish, encourage it to bring in the nationalist culture a little bit as well, if that was a possibility.
Okay, there's a challenge for us. I mean, I have to say it's an embarrassment to me as a person who grew up in Northern Ireland with great Protestant neighbours in Ballycastle, many of whom were in the Orange Order, to see that skull and crossbones as an orange symbol in Armagh. That's on the arch, yeah, and I think that's a disgrace. But I've said several things were a disgrace today, so I'm running out of firepower here. but to take that wider point, I think the whole question of how people are treated, what we're going to do about it. I mentioned a socialist party and then was shot down because I'd actually referred to the Labour Party as a socialist party. But I think the one thing we're all kind of agreeing on is that all of those problems about dispossession, unemployment, disability, etc., are foisted unevenly on whoever happens to be the weaker community. And, of course, I hear that call for culture, but that call for culture is also the thing that is driving besieged Muslims, and they can feel besieged in Britain because of everything that's been said about them in the Daily Mail and elsewhere, to feel that they have to cling to their own culture. And their own culture brings the kind of results that Yasmin has rejected today by saying, by refusing the veil, you are not going to take some medieval Saudi Arabian version of Islam when we had a much more. So if we can just have a kind of a, I was going to say a rounding up, a summing up, but hopefully a vote for the future from both of you, just
well,
where we go. Where
what
we go.
Helps also is to tell a different story. I mean, you two young women have told a different story. And I think the power of stories, I mean, Exotic England, the other book, I wrote partly in response to the UKIP Englanders who were claiming a pure, narrow-minded, small island kind of nationhood, and saying to them, listen, England is not a small island. England has an extraordinary story, starting with the 16th century. We know about the exploitation, but it was bigger than that. There was a lot more going on. There was genuine love between the Islamic world and the at least England. I didn't know Christopher Wren, when he made St. Paul's, he called that architecture Indo-Saracenic architecture as refined by Christians. So I wanted young Muslims to read that story and realize that they've not hated us since the Crusades. Actually, there's been immense love all the way through, ending with poor Diana, who had two Muslim lovers, right? And the mad Prince Charles wittering on about Islamic architecture. You know, it's never just straightforward. And then I want also, so telling a different story seems to me very important. And there's a different story here about, I interviewed Neil McGregor, director of the British Museum, and I said, why is England like this, expansive, absorbing, promiscuous? And he said it's to do with the Protestant church that was set up after, to take on the might of Rome when they decided to split. That they decided the only way to do this was to be eclectic, porous, not hard-edged, so they could build up. And therefore, and this is his words, England cannot be, ever be, a monocultural society. And I think in this, in Northern Ireland, if that story of Protestantism could be told, that it wanted not to be the hard-line, hard-edged Catholicism, what a difference that would make. So I think telling a different story would help immeasurably.
Yeah, I love that sort of as a summing up, the Clonmel's Presbyterian in me and the Huguenot refugee in me both want to vote for that one. There's another part of me that says, well, what's wrong with being a Catholic then? But anyway, let's. So Hannah, do you want to just sort of contribute something at the end?
Yeah, I'm probably going to really echo what Yasmin says really about the importance of narrative. The people here have talked today about narratives that are being told by the newspapers that don't fit their knowledge or their experience, or narratives that they know about but haven't been told in schools of education. And I think my experience around my own identity has always been one of there being another story. So when I used to tell people, yeah, my dad's, you know, he's half Chinese, half Jamaican, it was like, well, there's Chinese in Jamaica. There's a huge Chinese community in Jamaica, but it's not part of the narrative that we understand here about what the Caribbean is, you know? And then even the old narrative about the way I look, you know, actually, there are plenty of people that look like me that have got mixed race parents, you know. So, and that's a whole other another story that doesn't get told. So I guess I'm just up for kind of championing the idea of people telling their own personal and individual stories. It's almost as though these simplified stories, like the Windrush story, is a simplified story that probably answered some anxiety about Britain's multiculturalism in a time of great anxiety after the Second World War. Actually does a disservice to the intelligence of human beings. I mean, we're all capable of holding complex information in our heads, you know. So we can dismiss these simplified narratives, and we must be sceptical about them as well. And also have a great vote for compassion, I suppose, of human beings towards one another, as illustrated through what Yasmin said about the people that are friends of the detainees. I always think of the photograph, one of the picture post published these terrible photographs in the 1950s of like white women, beleaguered with white women holding these mixed race babies and these headlines, would you let your daughter marry a Negro? Right? Well, yeah, it was Stuart Hall, not the TV presenter, but the cultural theorist, talks about rereading that photograph, actually. You know, that happens, the black father isn't in the picture, but he might just be standing at the edge. And that is evidence that not only were these relationships fostered because there were shared unions and they worked in factories, but there was love. Yeah. You know, these people fell in love. So I'm having a vote for the other story and a vote for love and compassion.
Yeah. I just want to say thanks very much from the John Hewitt Society to two great speakers, thinkers, writers. One of our aims is to bring people here to talk to us about their perceptions of problems that we have and they have and we all have around the world, and stop us thinking that our problems are all entirely of our own making. Well, they are of our own making, let's admit it, but other people share those problems around the world. And secondly, one of the things we want to do is that people will come here and have a beautiful day, a beautiful festival in rainy Armagh, but it did brighten up for an hour today, and we'll go back and see that Northern Ireland is both not some terrible thing and not some forgotten thing, but part of how we all move forward. So I'd like you to thank again Yasmin Alibi Brown and
thank you.
And I did mention they're both great writers and they've both written great books, and David is a great bookseller, and there is a table at which they will give you their wonderful signatures if you ask them nicely.
And so, a smile.
And a smile.
And love and compassion.
And compassion.
A kiss. A kiss with each book, so.